Hi! Hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, for new Catholics, those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm Keith Little, an evangelical convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is based on one particular idea. It began for me when a Protestant pastor I was working for asked me the question, what's more important, the Bible or tradition? Well, that question led me on a deep dive in the history of Christianity, the history of the Bible, sola scriptura, the Reformation, and in that journey, I encountered the Catholic Church for the very first time in its own words. And I realized then that what I thought I knew about Catholics and the Catholic faith was based in large part on misinformation, and more often than not, on simple misunderstandings. This podcast serves to fill in that same gap, the gap between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. Each week, I have a real Catholic conversation with a real Catholic thinker from the heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And this week on the show, I am joined by my friend, Catholic anthropologist Joe Heschmeyer. He tackles for us the idea of Calvinism, the idea of predestination, one of these big Reformation-era ideas that was very important and remains incredibly important for some of the brightest and best thinkers of evangelical Christianity down through today. So this important topic, how does the Catholic Church understand this? How do Catholics respond to this? And importantly for our investigation here of Calvinism, was this like other Catholic ideas, like other important ideas that were challenged at the Reformation, was this found in the early church? Is there reason why the Reformers brought this out as an important thing? Where did it come from? How do we understand it? All these things in between. It's a fantastic episode to really equip you to understand where these things come from and how, as a Catholic, we can respond. We can answer these really important questions about our faith. And Joe's a wonderful guy to have this conversation with. I think you'll love it. This show is brought to you by our patrons at patreon.com/cordialcatholic and our one-time sponsors at paypal.me/cordialcatholic. If you want to support this show and the work that we do here, head over to those links. They're in the show notes. And thank you guys in advance for those of you who are already supporting this show week after week, helping it to keep going and growing. Thank you so much. And now, without any further ado, my fantastic conversation on Calvinism, the Catholic response to Calvinism with Catholic Answers apologist Joe Heschmeyer. Please listen and enjoy. Hey friends, welcome back to the show. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. If you are listening on podcast, thank you. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, follow the show and please leave a rating or review. That helps to push the podcast out to new people. And hey, if you're watching on YouTube, thanks for watching. Make sure you subscribe to this channel here, to Joe's channel as well. Those links are in the show notes, the description for this video. And thanks for watching. I am joined, I mentioned already this week, by Joe Heschmeyer. He's a staff apologist at Catholic Answers, the author of some fantastic books, including Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine, The Eucharist Is Really Jesus, and The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Is the Catholic Church? Was the Catholic Church.
I was just trying to remember today. I think it is the Catholic Church.
Is the Catholic Church. And the host of one of my favorite podcasts, the Shameless Popery podcast. Joe, welcome to the show. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure to have you, Joe. Appreciate the work that you do. I am a huge fan of your podcast and your work, Joe. I think it's the one, the little purple icon when it appears in my new feed of shows every week and it comes up there. It's the first thing I listen to. Whatever I'm listening to, I just stop and I put you on because it's awesome content.
I appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
And I was looking before, too, for your books on my bookshelf and I can't find them because... And this, I think, is a good sign of a good author. I give them away. So
nice.
I don't have them anymore because I get them, I read them, and then I pass them along right away. So I have them in your books on my bookshelf because they get given away.
Can I say this? Like, before I was an author, I think I wondered if you give somebody else's books away, like, would they be complimented or would they be like, oh no, I lost that money? Now that I realize how much you actually get per book as an author, by all means, give them away. Like, I would much rather have somebody read the book than get that like dollar royalty or whatever. You know, like it's, no one's going to starve if you give the book away. Funny. And hopefully it'll lead someone into a deeper encounter with Jesus Christ.
That's fantastic. I didn't think of that giving it away that you're not getting that extra.
This is probably me being neurotic, just me being like overthinking these things. But I was kind of like, you know, because I've had those books. I'm just like, everyone needs to read this.
Yeah, yeah. Now they're yours. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Truly, though, they're fantastic stuff. And this topic, too, I was thinking of who to, because I get all kinds of emails and requests for different topics and different guests. They'll say, get a guy on this, or get somebody on this, or, you know, wondering how to address this. And I've got lots of emails on this topic. And I thought, who can I get to kind of unpack this area of theology? This kind of intersection of like the early church and the Catholic Church and Protestantism and the Reformation. And you had a recent, I don't know if it's an episode or part of an episode on this topic. And I thought, this is it. This is, we'll get Joe back on the show because you have the through line on this. You have like your finger on the pulse of this area of theology and church history and the Reformation. So I'm excited to have you unpack this with us, Joe. And I was thinking, I've mentioned before on the show where I first encountered the idea of Calvinism, our topic this week. And for me, it was as an evangelical in youth group, of all places, right? A Pentecostal youth group. We were not Calvinists, as far as I knew at the time in my, you know, limited high school knowledge of theology. But we had a guy in the youth group who bought a book and read that book and was exploring Calvinism. And he came to our youth group and he began sharing these ideas of Calvinism. And it began to spread in the youth group. And people began to question, am I saved? Am I among this elect that's described in this understanding of Calvinism? Am I, like, what's going on? And it became such a crisis in our small youth group that the senior pastor of our Pentecostal church had to come in one Friday night and address the youth group to explain, you know, as Pentecostals, you know, we believe this about predestination and Calvinism and salvation. And I had friends, you know, kind of, even back then, Joe, who, I don't know if they fell away from the faith completely, but seriously began to question their faith, their understanding of their faith, based on this kind of influx of these kind of Calvinist ideas into our little unsuspecting youth group. And, you know, years later, when I began to look into the Catholic Church and the early church and do a real study of the history of the church and the Reformation and these things, I remember in encountering this again, and this being that kind of memory that triggered for me back in youth group. And I went, you know what? This really was one of the early seeds that I encountered, this kind of division, these divisions in the theology of the Protestant movement that I couldn't back then understand. Well, why do we believe this? And these guys believe this. We have the same Bible. What, you know, we're in part of the same church. You know, we're in the same youth group. How can we have different opinions on these things that seem like they should be a source of unity? So this for me was one of those early encounters with one of the kind of the problems I saw of Protestantism that eventually led me into becoming Catholic. So, you know, looking back, it's fascinating. And today, a question that many people encounter and go, well, why do we believe this and they believe this? You know, how can, first of all, within the same Protestant kind of theology, like the Protestant church, I should say, different opinions on this. And then as opposed to Catholic theology and the theology, the understanding of the early church as well, because these things are kind of all, you know, wrapped up in there. So I'm happy to have you here unwrapping for us and help us to navigate this. I think we can start with, or should start with, maybe just a definition of, you know, broadly speaking, what we mean by Calvinism, I think. And I don't know if we can necessarily wrap up just one definition. Yeah. It's pretty part of the problem. But,
well, and you'll find people who are self-described Calvinists who disagree on some of the things we're about. So let's just give two sets of criteria to look for. The first, the Synod of Dort, was an early kind of Calvinist attempt to figure out what is meant by Calvinism. And the acronym TULIP is associated with this, or the 5 points of 5-point Calvinism. And so those 5 points... the T is total depravity. And this is the key to understanding the whole system. Is that sin doesn't just wound you. You're dead. And when you're dead, you can do literally nothing. And so you can do no good thing. And so there's nothing worthwhile you can do. And so there's no sense we can talk about your will. And so in technical terms, Calvinism is monergistic rather than synergistic. Monergistic meaning one will, it's God's will. Rather than synergistic, where God's will works with our will. So even though Calvin is a huge fan of St. Augustine, they actually part company pretty sharply on this point. You know, Augustine in his commentary in the Psalms says that God who made you without you will not save you without you. And in Calvinism, he has to save you without you because you are so dead in sin that you can do nothing. Now, while we're talking on that point, I think a good passage to look to is actually the passage of the prodigal son. Because the prodigal son, we see him going back to the father, and the father says, my son who is dead is now alive. And so being dead in this biblical language didn't stop him from turning back to the father. Having said that, one thing the Calvinist system gets right that some of the free will versions of Protestantism get wrong is that faith is a gift, but so is even the grace of conversion. It is a grace. And so even when you think you're the one turning back to God, it's only because God has first made that overture to you. So we could get very deep in the weeds very quickly with that, but this is the tea in TULIP, total depravity. And so, you know, and sometimes it's contrasted with utter depravity. It's you might say those sound like completely the same thing. Utter depravity is kind of the caricature version of total depravity. And so a Calvinist who isn't comfortable going as far as maybe another one will call anything further than his position utter depravity. So your mileage can vary, but that's the tea in TULIP. And so it's the key to the whole thing, because if your salvation can't involve your free cooperation or your free will of saying yes or no, then everything else seems to sort of follow from that. The you is unconditional election, that God's elect cannot lose their salvation. They can't lose their election. So in Catholicism and for 1500 years in Christianity, it was very clear that there are what are called mortal sins. You know, St. John talks about how there's sin that is deadly and sin that isn't. The deadly sin we call mortal sin. That's literally what it means. And the other sin, we coined the term venial sin because John doesn't name it. And so we have this 1500-year tradition of saying, okay, you can certainly lose your faith through this. And the early reformers, even someone like Martin Luther, who believes in the bondage of the will and writes a book to that effect, still believes you can lose your salvation through a loss of faith. In the Calvinist system, that's not possible. And we'll get into why that's not possible. Basically, you are so corrupt that if you could lose your salvation, you would. And so it cannot be possible for you to lose your salvation. That leads to the L in TULIP, limited atonement. And the idea here is, okay, well, if this is all just a matter of God's will, why doesn't he just save everybody? And in fact, this is the kind of logical hole in Calvinism in a lot of ways. If you look at the Puritan communities in the United Kingdom, in the Netherlands, and in the United States, or, you know, the American colonies, all of them end up becoming, I mean, not every individual, but every community, you start to find these outbreaks of universalism, where you go from these very conservative Puritans to these very liberal, in some cases, Unitarian universalists. And before he died, I had a chance to ask Cardinal George about this of Chicago. And, you know, because he was an expert on the colonial era. And I said, I've seen this pattern. I don't know what's going on. And he said, well, universalism is just Calvinism with mercy added to it. That if it's going to be monergistic, it's just going to be God saves whoever he wants and no one can say no to his offer of salvation. And if scripture says God desires all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of truth, why in the world would he not save everyone? How does it possibly further his glory more to damn a bunch of people when he could save all of them and have them rejoicing, praising him and honoring him forever in heaven? So both on the level of God's mercy and even on the level of his glory and sovereignty, it doesn't make a lot of sense from the internal logic of Calvinism for that to be the case. But limited atonement is kind of logically required if you're going to say some people go to hell and some people go to heaven. Well, if the ones that went to hell must not have been saved by Christ or else they would be in heaven. And so therefore, you have to say Christ didn't actually die for everyone. And that's what it means to say the atonement is limited. If you talk to someone who says they're a four-point Calvinist, it's usually this point that they're rejecting because it seems bad. I don't know another way. I can't find a nicer way to say it. Like a version in which God creates some people who cannot possibly be saved, who have no choice in the matter, who Jesus comes and dies on the cross and does not desire for his death to save them, even while he's crying out to save his persecutors, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. There's this other group of people that he just does not care about bringing into heaven, or doesn't want to bring into heaven because he hates them, that he made, so bad that they're abhorrent to him, despite him making them that way. That boggles the mind and the heart, I think. So that's limited atonement. The I is irresistible grace. And you can kind of see the logic here. Even though, you know, Acts warns us not to be resistors of the Holy Spirit, Calvinism teaches you actually can't be a resistor of the Holy Spirit. Because if you could resist the Holy Spirit, you would. So grace has to be irresistible. And then the P is perseverance of the saints. This is what is in evangelical circles sometimes called once saved, always saved. It's the idea that those whom God has elected could not possibly fall away and will never fall away. If they do fall away, it's only for a limited amount of time, and then they're coming back and they're guaranteed never to go to hell.
Yeah.
That's actually just one of the, that's TULIP. The other kind of Calvinist distinctive that I think is worth mentioning, and maybe we'll want to spend some time on, and it's, if you followed the whole idea of limited atonement, you'll see this kind of baked in there, is what's called double predestination. Now, very clearly in Scripture, there's the idea of predestination, that God plans this order of salvation and he brings it about. And so there is predestination, so that when a person is in heaven and they are saved, it is not primarily because of anything they did, that they, you know, earned it or anything like that. It is that God prepared from all eternity this work of salvation, and they either received it or cooperated with it, depending on your theology, but God is the author of it. That's single predestination. That's relatively uncontroversial. The double predestination is the same, except rather than that, it's God preparing for all eternity for some people to go to hell. And there's no Bible verse that actually teaches that, but it is a logical consequence of the Calvinist system that you have to kind of affirm, seemingly. And because it's very much this view of predestination as kind of this inexorable kind of fate that you just can't do anything. You know, if you're familiar with like the old Greek myth, it's the thing about like Oedipus Rex. Oedipus, you know, the oracles foretell his future. And so they do everything they can to try to change the future and end up just playing into it. Or hey, it was just this afternoon listening to Sleeping Beauty with my daughter. And in the original version of Sleeping Beauty, there's this, you know, foretelling that she's going to prick her finger and die on her 16th birthday. And so they get rid of all of the spinning wheels. And lo and behold, she finds the one and she pricks her finger on her 16th birthday.
Yeah, way to go.
Yeah. And it's that kind of idea. Like no matter what you do, you can't get away from either heaven or hell that God has prepared for you. And so it's much more, I think as we're going to see, it's actually much closer to the pagan idea of fate than it is to anything that the early Christians believed.
Yeah, yeah. And again, that's the kind of, as viewed through a high school youth group lens, that's the kind of thing that I know. I sat down with people at the table at McDonald's after youth group, like on a Friday night, who go, I think I'm destined to hell. I think in the system, like I'm one of the, I struggle with my faith. I think I'm one of the ones that's just going to hell. Like that's
yeah, it is incredibly discouraging.
Disturbing.
For someone who might find themselves in a place of struggle.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if you just find things are going really badly for you. You might be like, well, this is a sign God doesn't love me or care about me. And so you can imagine the real spiritual damage is caused by this.
Yeah.
St. Francis de Sales, early on in his life, had a very similar struggle. He was in southern France where there was a lot of this in the air. You know, Geneva was very close to where he grew up in Annecy, I believe. And so he thought he was doomed to hell. And eventually he just resolved to love God no matter what. And he ended up becoming a great saint. But you could imagine someone in that same spot just saying, well, there's no use trying. Because in a real way, there is no use trying.
Yeah, that's interesting and disturbing.
Yeah.
So I want to explore the roots of this in a sense, for one thing. But I also want to explore the Catholic the counter to this. So what does the church make of this, right? Because this, I think we'll explore that this is not what the church believed for the first 1500 years, right, of church history. But I mean, is it possible in a nutshell to say, okay, so this is what this is. What does the church believe? And then we'll kind of unpack, or should we unpack, do the unpacking first?
Oh, no, we can, I can give like a sort of the 20,000 foot view. Like I said earlier, there, I want to affirm the either the things Calvinism is getting right, or at least the emphases that are in the right direction. Because I think it's easy to fall into something closer to the opposite extreme, something like Pelagianism, where it's just like, oh, we just do it all ourselves, yeah, and then God rewards us. And so this is sometimes, I think, wrongly ascribed to Catholics.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't think, I've never met a Catholic priest who taught this, but I think there's enough of this in the kind of do-it-yourself culture in America. I don't know how it is in Canada, but at least here in the U.S., there can be this kind of like, oh, I got to figure it all out for myself. I was actually talking to somebody who was saying he worked with a guy who once said, oh, I admire, you know, I'm not a Christian, but if I were, I'd be a Catholic, because you get to really like do it yourself to get to salvation. And it'd be like,
oh, no,
I hate to tell you this, but like, that's not how that works. But that's the danger. I think a lot of half-churched and unchurched people can kind of come to. And there's a real spiritual danger of that as well, of thinking like, I need to figure out my own life and then I'll be worthy to come to God. And it's like, that's not how it works. Like, God loves you in your unloveliness and desires to purify and save you and make you godlike. And so if you're trying to do that on your own, you're never going to get there. And so rather than that, let God do the actual healing. Let God do the actual fixing. So I think one thing that we should actually probably start with in a Catholic Calvinist conversation is that point of agreement. That compared to the broader culture, compared to the, you know, sort of shallow theology Christian, there's a lot of an exaggerated sense of the role of free will and an underappreciation for the primacy of God's divine action. And in a real way, the primacy of grace. And, you know, so now I'm going to throw out a thing that I realize could be a much, much bigger conversation. On one of the Marian feast days, I want to say Immaculate Conception. The second reading is the famous passage on predestination from St. Paul in Romans 8. And it's because if you want to understand predestination, look to Mary. And I think there's something both Catholics and Calvinists can learn from there, because Mary is like a great example of someone who is completely predestined. She doesn't deserve to be without sin, but she is without sin from the moment of her conception by a singular grace and gift of God. She did nothing to earn it. She could have done nothing to earn it. She responds to the gift, but she is given this completely unmerited gift in the order of predestination. And so I think it's something worth pondering, both to help Calvinists understand Mary and to help Catholics understand predestination, that like there's something we can really point to there. And you see it, of course, in the lives of all the saints, where you just say, well, what are the odds that happened? And you're like, well, I guess 100%, because God chose for it to happen. And that's, you know, very much kind of how predestination works. The point where we diverge, and, well, there's a few places we diverge, but one of them is, we have to respect within predestination that there is still human accountability, because there's human choice. How choice works is mysterious under the best of circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we can have these conversations in-house as Christians. Non-Christians have these conversations as well. You know, among atheists, you have biological predeterminists. And so, you know, I already mentioned among the pagans, you had the Greeks who were fatalists. So there is within atheism, within paganism, within Christianity, like one branch that goes in a really everything is predetermined, and one branch that says, no, it's not. And so we want to acknowledge both, that God outside of time has an eternal plan of salvation. He's not surprised by anything. And also that God's plan of salvation includes our free response in it, which he already knows about and builds into the plan.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
So we talk about this idea of being something new, right? The idea that, and this is what I encountered in my own kind of exploration of the history of Christianity and looking in the history of the Bible and the church and then into the early church, and this whole kind of journey that I went on looking into the roots of my Protestant Christian faith, And I was looking for things like this. I was looking for the, you know, well, okay, so where am I going to find this throughout history? Where am I going to find this, you know, in the early church, in the roots of Christianity? And I, you know, was surprised, I think as anyone, to discover what seems like, well, I don't know that I can find it there in the early church. And at the same time, I contrast this, this is complimented, or this is, I don't know, highlighted by people doing work, you know, modern, great modern apologists, someone like Dr. Gavin Ortland, who's a professed Calvinist, who does work looking at the early church and retrieving that theology of the early church and the early, you know, early Protestantism and those kinds of things, and others besides, who are trying to, you know, kind of base a Protestant faith on, say, the early church. When I looked into the early church, and I'm no theologian, I've not studied these things at that great depth and have various degrees and huge time to do these things, I didn't find it, Joe. I didn't find a lot of these kind of ideas of Calvinism in the roots of Christianity. But there are many ardent Calvinists who subscribe to this theology, who see value in the early church, but also hold this idea of Calvinism, and which seems, I don't know how it fits together. Maybe it does. I don't know. So when we look at kind of the history of Christianity, we look at the earliest Christians, we look at the church that Christ founded, because that was the goal for myself and many listeners to this show who are on that journey of looking into the roots of the faith. I didn't see it there. I saw a church that looked like, as your book is titled, a Catholic church, and had Catholic ideas of predestination and these kinds of things, understanding of God's grace and how this works. So when we look at the roots of Christianity, how do we reconcile the idea of Calvinism with, I mean, the Catholic faith that we hold that purports to go back to, you know, the very beginning, and this idea of Calvinism?
Yeah, I want to say two things at the outset. One, the average person listening to this, I imagine, is going to feel daunted by the task of just jumping into the church fathers by themselves and doing the primary source research, which is, of course, a great way to find out the answer. But as a result, they're going to find themselves in this perplexing kind of situation where you have Catholics saying, oh, nope, it's not there. And Calvinists saying, oh, yes, it is. Right. And both sides maybe even pulling out some quotes. So that's one thing I wanted to say at the outset. I think I can solve that, maybe. the second, as I say, you pulling out some quotes, you will find some lines, particularly from St. Augustine in his later, like post-390s, or like from the mid-390s on, stuff that sounds, without context, much more Calvinist. And it's actually not more Calvinist, but is it, I mean, I guess I should say, it's not Calvinist. It is closer to Calvinism than some of his earlier stuff. And I think that's an important shift to recognize and make sense of. And this is something that virtually every scholar who understands Augustine will point to, that in response to the crisis of Pelagianism, Augustine sort of moves in the opposite direction enough that he gets pushback from other saints. So those are just two things to say at the outset, because I believe Augustine is cited 125 times in John Calvin's Institutes of Christian Religion. Like, he dwarfs everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you get someone like Luther, who's an Augustinian. He's an Augustinian monk. Calvin's not an Augustinian in that sense, but he certainly is an admirer of a lot of Augustine. And so there's a certain version of St. Augustine that the Reformers create or present that is in the popular imagination and has some quotes behind it. And so I can understand why people come out that way. So, okay, with those as kind of a preamble, the first thing I want to say is John Calvin basically admits that there is no Calvinism before the 390s, that nobody before Augustine, at least, believes what he believes. He says this in Institutes of Christian Religion in Book 2, Chapter 2, Section 4. He says, moreover, although the Greek fathers above others, and especially Chrysostom, have exceeded due bounds in extolling the powers of the human will, yet all ancient theologians, with the exception of Augustine, are so confused, vacillating, and contradictory on this subject that no certainty can be obtained from their writings. So he is of the opinion that every ancient theologian other than Augustine is not just wrong, but has no idea what they're talking about. Yeah. And this is the really remarkable view that, like, Luther has similar lines where he basically just treats all the early Christians as idiots.
Yeah.
And so he's of this view. Oh, they don't know what they're vacillating. They're, you know, they're confused. Well, they're really not confused or vacillating. They're just not Calvinists. So Alistair McGrath, Justitia Dei, this is the work that often gets referenced because he's a Calvinist who's acknowledging that the Reformers' doctrine of justification is a theological novum. Elsewhere in the book, he says this: the pre-Augustinian theological tradition is practically of one voice in asserting the freedom of the human will. And then he gives examples of this. For instance, Justin Martyr rejects the idea that all human actions are foreordained on the grounds that this eliminates human accountability. And if you want to explore it, I've got the quote. We can look at Justin in his own words. The argument is supplemented by an appeal to scriptural texts apparently teaching man's freedom of action, such as Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 19. I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life that you may live. The point there is that they weren't actually confused or vacillating or contradictory. They were very clear. They were unanimous. They just didn't agree with Calvin. And given that, and strikingly, when you read Justin, he is speaking of this as something that's been handed down to the, like, from the apostles.
Yeah.
And this is striking because he's writing in the 160s. And so that's completely plausible. Like, he's close enough to the time of the apostles that when he says this is what they taught about the reality of human free will, it's like, well, that seems real. That seems plausible. He's, you know, not even 60, or, you know, not even 70 years removed from the time of the apostles. So given all of that, I mean, I would just say the first thing to say is that you will find plenty of Calvinists, including Calvin himself, who acknowledge Calvinism isn't found in the earliest days of the church. There is a work called Calvinism Before Calvin. I think it's Wright. What is his name? Sorry, I'm going to find it here. A Calvinist Before Calvin, and it's by Wright, who was, I think, Southern Baptist Seminary. And he goes to try to find, as you might imagine, Calvinists before Calvin, and he can't. And he just sort of waves the problem away. He says, I'm actually going to quote him here. He says, the early Christians, as we talked about, were just wrong in their interpretation of the biblical text and the conclusions that they drew from it. And then he gives some examples. He says, after all, they erred in other doctrines. At least this confessional Baptist thinks they did, such as in their swift move toward Episcopal authority in the churches, some of the magical views they associated with the Lord's Supper, their turn toward infant baptism, and some of their overly allegorical biblical interpretations. So the thing I want to point out there is, like, Wright is just following this Baptist logic to its logical limit. Like, if the church fathers, the earliest church fathers, I'm not saying, like, somebody in the 500s or something, yeah, where you say, oh, there's plenty of time to get corrupted. In the 100s, they're saying, well, they're not just wrong on one issue. They're wrong on all sorts of stuff. If you take that view seriously, it undermines any reasonable belief in Christianity. By that, I don't mean the early Christians were infallible. That's not the argument at all. But if you think they were heretics and they didn't understand the Bible, they didn't understand the gospel, they didn't understand the things that the apostles taught them, they got free will wrong. They got baptism wrong. They got Eucharist wrong. They got the structure of the church wrong. Somehow, basically to a man, they screwed up all of these things. But what reasonable basis can you say, but we think they got the Trinity right. We think they got the Christological doctrines right. We think they got the books of the New Testament right. Are those issues easier or hard? I mean, it doesn't seem clear to me that if they couldn't figure out the difference between a bishop and a presbyter, or couldn't figure out, you know, that the Eucharist is supposed to just be a symbol, if you really believe that stuff seriously, if they thought somehow that there was human free will when apparently the apostles were like, no, there's not. If they got something that basic, that wrong for that long, why would you then believe that they got the canon right? The first time we hear Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John or the four gospels is 180. by Irenaeus, who believes in human free will and is 20 years after Justin Martyr. So I'm just trying to figure out, like, what coherent sort of vision of the church or of theology says, yeah, somehow the Holy Spirit protected the exact right books of the Bible, although they don't actually think we got the exact right books of the Bible. Imagine.
Yeah, close enough.
Yeah, that said, you know, we came close to getting the right books of the Bible. Like, what is that vision of the church? And if all of this is done, ironically, in the name of the sovereignty of God, which is the great defense of double predestination, a God who can't preserve his message even into the next generation of Christianity doesn't come out looking particularly sovereign. It looks like sin overwhelms the gospel about as fast as an avocado goes bad. And like, that is just not the church that is not going to be overcome by the gates of hell that Jesus promised us.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those things too that divides, right? I mean, even at the Reformation, right? When these different ideas begin to emerge and Calvin comes out on the side of Calvinism, ironically enough, I guess it probably was named, you know what? I don't know. Was it named? that's an issue of predestination, I guess. Was it destined to be named Calvinism before he inherited the name? Or was it?
Actually, you know, you joke. There is a debate about to what extent Calvin would be considered a Calvinist by the standards of the Synod of Dort.
Yeah, that's...
Because there's some ambiguities in his own writing.
Oh, that's pretty deep. But, you know, there is one of those things that divides, right? That divides reformers at the Reformation, right? That divides Protestantism at the Reformation, this idea of predestination as it emerges, right? So again, it begs the question, even just logically, if this is the plan of God, the early church got it wrong. And then when it emerges, it divides even the movement that's meant to reground Christianity in the Reformation, right? So these reformers didn't get it right, and these did. I mean, even that kind of a situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a strange idea that, okay, Jesus Christ sets up a church on earth. That church very, very quickly falls into apostasy. A German monk somehow was able to restart it, but he still doesn't quite get the message of Calvinism right. And then a French lawyer comes along and finishes the work.
Ah, mais oui.
Neither Luther nor Calvin significantly claim to be prophets, you know, perform any miracles or do any of these things that you would associate with a prophet or a founder of a religion. And yet they're supposed to be, you know, the Mormon claim, as patently absurd as it may seem to non-Mormons, has an internal coherence in that if you take the idea seriously that the church fell into apostasy, well, it makes sense to say, well, and then a prophet came along with, you know, this supernatural gift and was able to restore, resurrect that church. But to just say like a monk and a lawyer did it, what are you talking about? they don't have, those are not in their skill set. At least it doesn't appear obvious how it would be. So yeah, it is this strange thing to think like, oh, the Reformation was willed by God, but the Reformation isn't speaking with one voice. It's actually teaching contradictory creeds, not just contradictory to Catholicism, contradictory among itself, which is not the hallmark of a movement of God. Think about Gamaliel's famous challenge in the book of Acts. He argues that if he looks at all these other messianic movements that divided and split and factionalized very quickly, especially after the death of their founders, and said that this is going to be the test. And if Christianity does that, that'll prove that it's not real. And so the oneness of the early church was actually a sign of it being providentially protected by God. And more importantly, a sign that Jesus isn't just one of these, you know, founders who then the whole thing breaks apart upon their death. So think about like Muhammad, when he dies, there's no plan of succession. And so Shia and Sunni split. Joseph Smith, when he dies, there's no plan of succession. And so you get the LDSCR, LDS Beckerites and everybody else. When Jesus dies and is resurrected and then ascends into heaven, you don't see the different apostles setting up different denominations. You don't see a bunch of different churches. The church remains one. This is the great irony of the people saying, oh, well, they're all confused and vacillating, is they don't appear to think that is true of one another. They're not like fighting about free will and predestination in these first few centuries. And so they look like they're speaking with one voice. They look like they're acting with one voice much more than the reformers did. And so, like, if you want to talk about confused and vacillating or contradictory, compare Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, Henry VIII, Cranmer, and you're going to find very different understandings of free will and predestination, especially if you start bringing in some of the other kind of figures.
Yeah. Now, what do we make of, because, I mean, of course, Calvinists do use Augustine, and there's quotes they can bring forward from Augustine to make it seem like, okay, despite maybe we can't find them, maybe Calvin himself mm-hmm. said we can't find them in the earlier church fathers, but Augustine has these things he says that sound very predestined-like, you know, the quotes we can pull out. And these will be trotted out to say, look, Augustine believed this, maybe no one else did, but here's one, you know, early church father who did. So, you know, and so, of course, beloved by, for lots of reasons, by many Protestants and Calvinists. Mm-hmm. What do we make of these times when Augustine sounds like he might believe in the predestination of Calvin?
Yeah, so I think it's important to make a couple distinctions. First, again, as I mentioned before, Augustine early on focuses a lot on free will, and later on focuses a lot on God's sovereign willing of the salvation of the individual. Second, this shift in his thinking is pretty explicitly in response to the errors and heresy of Pelagians, which take things way too far in one direction. And so he kind of pushes in the opposite direction. And third, there's this pivotal moment in the mid-390s where St. Simplicin reaches out to him and is asking how he makes sense of Romans chapter 9, verses 10 to 29. And St. Augustine responds, and I'll quote him here, "You ask that the whole passage be discussed, and indeed it is rather obscure. But to be sure, I know your regard for me, and I'm certain that you would not bid me expound that passage unless you'd prayed the Lord to give me the ability to do so. With such confidence in his help, I approach the task." So notice here, this is going to be the pivotal moment in which he starts reading the order of salvation as God's action in a way that seems much more monergistic than his earlier writings had suggested. He's not claiming this is something he received from the apostles. He's doing his best to interpret a passage that he admits he finds obscure. So it's perfectly reasonable in that situation to say, maybe he innocently misread it. Like, it's possible to find in a passage of scripture you think is confusing. You pray about it. You make the best sense you can of it. You're not 100% guaranteed going to get that right. Compare that to the earlier people like Justin Martyr, who aren't saying, we're trying to make sense of this confusing data, but this is what we think is going on. Rather, say Justin Martyr says, we have learned from the prophets, and we hold it as true that punishments and chastisements and good rewards are distributed according to the merits of each man's actions. Were this not the case, and were all things to happen according to the decree of fate, there'd be nothing at all in our power. If fate decrees that this man is to be good and that one wicked, then neither is the former to be praised nor the latter to be blamed. So the view of predestination of just one group towards heaven, one group towards hell, as I said before, is very similar to the popular Greek view of fate, where it was just this thing you had no control over, and so your life was purposeless because you could do nothing to kind of change it. And Justin was saying, that is not what we were taught. He's not saying, I'm doing my best to figure out this passage, and I think it doesn't teach that. No, he's very clear as someone in the situation to say that, like, no, that's not what we received from those with prophetic authority. And so I think given that, if you have to say, how do we harmonize Augustine and Justin? And Augustine seems to disagree with himself. I mean, it's very clear in Retractiones that he does disagree with himself, finds the passage confusing. It's much more accurate to say he vacillates, is self-contradictory, and is confused on this. And I say this with great love for Augustine, to just say don't treat him as like the preeminent theological authority on this, because he's also not an eyewitness to the kind of apostolic teaching in the way Justin is in this apostolic father's era. He's at, you know, the tail end of people who learned either from the apostles or from the students of the apostles. In his case, from a student of the apostles.
Yeah. And I guess the tendency, I mean, amongst, and I'm sure that Catholics do this too, right? Privately. I don't think that the church doesn't necessarily do this writ large, but I'm sure you know, we do this. I certainly am guilty of this from time to time. But the overwhelming tendency in Protestant Christianity is to find sources like this and cling on to Augustine as, okay, so he says this, and he's a prominent church father, and so his word is not gospel, but his word is very weighty on this topic because he kind of weighs in. Here's a guy from history, mm-hmm. right? That there's that tendency to kind of pick out different church fathers and put them at kind of a prominence, right? So
yes.
He believed this, so I'm going to adopt this theology. I can remember my friend, Dr. Doug Beaumont, doing research for the late Norman Geisler, one of his theological mm-hmm. texts down in Southern Evangelical Seminary. And, you know, Doug's task was to, you know, I think he was a master's student at the time working under Geisler, was to go through the early church and find quotes that backed up some of these different views that Geisler was putting as important, you know, the essentials, quote unquote, for evangelical Christianity.
Yeah.
And Doug said all he was doing was just kind of going through, you know, the sources, the early church fathers, and just doing a keyword search and kind of pulling that out and attaching that to, you know, putting that in a spreadsheet, thinking, he said at the time, that this would be kind of gone through and the context really picked over. Well, it wasn't. It was just attached right. to, you know, this document as here's where this view here is backed up in the early church. And I'm not accusing everyone of doing that, or even Geisler of doing that uncritically. That this is Doug's kind of view of what happened with his research. But there's that tendency to pick out, okay, so here's what Augustine says on predestination. We're going to take him as this guy who, he says this, it means something weighty, right? Despite it, as you say, not being attached necessarily to history. And Augustine himself not saying, look, I'm saying this in the spirit of what of all those who come before me and the history of what we believe, right? It's kind of taking that out of context and elevating it, right? I think
I have a podcast episode coming out this Thursday. By the time this airs, I don't know, maybe out. I don't know when this is coming out. Probably will be out already. In which I look at this exact thing in terms of the history of justification by faith alone.
Yeah.
Because Tony Lane, who is Oxford educated. He is a professor of historical doctrine at London School of Theology. He is a Protestant who is the author of a lot of books on Calvin and translations on Calvin texts and all this. He acknowledges sola fide is not taught in the early church. And so this is a pretty striking kind of admission. He's not alone. Alistair McGrath, that I already mentioned, does the same thing in Eustacia Dei. And long before them, the 19th century church historian Philip Schaff said the same thing. And these are all Protestants who are extremely well-read, particularly in the area of historical theology, all saying the same thing. Schaff said, if one expects to find in this period, he's looking at the year 100 to 311, or in any of the church fathers, Augustine himself not accepted the Protestant doctrine of justification by faith alone as the article by which the church stands and falls, he will be greatly disappointed. And, you know, and in fact, he goes on to say that fathers lay chief stress on sanctification and good works and show the already existing germs of the Roman Catholic doctrine of the meritoriousness and even the supererogatory meritoriousness of Christian virtue. And so I mention this to say, here are these three well-respected, careful historical theologians, in the case of McGrath and Lane, and church historian in the case of Schaff. And that's one side of kind of the Protestant scholarly aisle. The other side of the Protestant scholarly aisle are these kind of popular level professors. So they're not like just, you know, YouTube personalities or something, but they are professors, but they're writing for popular audiences, and they're doing the thing that you're talking about Geisler doing, where they're just taking quotes out of context. And so I look at the book Long Before Luther by Nathan Busenitz as one who's doing this, because he openly disagrees with Lane. He openly disagrees with McGrath while acknowledging, I'll quote him here. For McGrath, he says, Alistair McGrath is one of broader evangelicalism's foremost thinkers. And then he says, having taught historical theology at Oxford, McGrath is certainly qualified to trace the history of doctrinal discussions throughout the centuries. And yet, Busenitz claims he just gets all of this wrong, that actually there were a bunch of people before Luther who taught sola fide. And then when you look at the things that Busenitz claims as evidence, he begins what he calls the chorus of affirming voices of the doctrine of sola fide. And the first one he quotes is Clement of Rome. And he quotes 1 Clement 32, which is without a doubt one of the strongest kind of proof texts you could find for sola fide, because he does say there that we are saved by faith alone. But Bucinets cuts out three paragraphs earlier where he says we're justified by our works.
Yeah.
And in quotes, like actually verbatim, he says we are being justified by our works. So he just takes half of it where it sounds very Lutheran and doesn't have the other half where it's clear that he doesn't actually think the Lutheran thing. And then he does the same thing with Origen in a more dramatic sort of way. He quotes a line from Thomas Scheck, where he says, Origen recognizes that sometimes scripture says that human beings are justified by faith alone. And it cuts out all the context where Scheck says this was an extraordinary case of the good thief, and that's not Origen's theology at all. And it's all there on the page, where the most charitable interpretation is that he was just doing like a control F find and wasn't intentionally misrepresenting. But the point is, of all of that, I know it's a very long-winded way of saying, this is how not to do any kind of analysis of the church fathers, where you just say, here's this line that agrees with me. You can do that for all sorts of things out of context. I mean, I've seen pro-choice people do this to try to make it look like early Christians were fine with abortion. That is in a ridiculous position. And so the fact is, you can take things out of context. And so what I'm advising is not just, hey, here are some great Catholic sounding lines. It's read them in context. And that context may include something like Augustine grappled with how to make sense of this. And he said things that don't harmonize very well internally.
Yeah. 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 And that's the case for, you know, like you say, for a lot of these different issues, right? And I think it's important to put things in context. Like, I think you do a great job of that often, Joe, or properly putting things back into context, and they may have been kind of ripped out of context, right? And to realize that these are all thinkers that, right in the history of Christianity, in the history of this rich theological tradition, that they shouldn't be just taken out one at a time and kind of understood, right? This is they're writing as part of a larger corpus, as a in writing in a tradition, and many of these guys were bishops, were priests, were theologians, were part of, you know, the Catholic Church. Whether or not we can take the writings and find things that aren't Catholic in them in different contexts, many of them were part of this, quite literally part of this institution, right? They believed the things that the institution believed, right? They believed the Eucharist was a certain thing, right? And believed that baptism did a certain thing, and these other things they believed, even when you might find something that they write that sounds like a thing that is anti-Catholic. Well, they were part of this church, right? They were doing the things the church did, right?
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, where when you say like St. Augustine, Bishop of Hippo, well, already you're like, okay, he's the Bishop of the Catholic Church. So maybe on some area where the Catholic Church hadn't clearly formally defined some doctrine, and he's doing some theology on the frontiers, as it were, he's not going to get things perfectly. Nobody does. I don't. I mean, I've got things where I can go back and say, oh, that was a bad argument, I shouldn't have done that. And I've got a lot less to work with than Augustine did. I mean, he has who knows how many writings. So the fact that he might have made some mistakes in some of them shouldn't be shocking or scandalous. The danger is there's a sort of Frankenstein patristics that you can fall into, that you find with, like, let's just cobble together every erroneous Protestant sounding line from any of the church fathers with no context. And the result isn't any real position held by one real person in antiquity. The result is just like a collection of opinions at one point said over a 500-year span that if you put them together might make a Presbyterian. But it's like, yeah, but there weren't any Presbyterians. So the fact that, like, maybe you could find one person who'd agree with you on one issue and another person who'd agree with you on another issue, you would be disfellowshipped, to use the Protestant term. By all of the people you're quoting, and you wouldn't feel comfortable with them preaching in your church, that should be a red flag.
Yeah.
On the flip side, if a Catholic were to go in this, they might be able to say, you know what, in a few hundred years, we're going to sort that one out. But you wouldn't say, we have opposite faiths or anything like this. We're not looking at one another as heretics. It's a whole different, it's hard to explain it any more than you don't want the quote, you want the person. And if you've taken the quote away from the person, where it's just like this floating proof text, you've missed something really critical.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you could, and as you explained before, people can change and grow and have opinions that are fallible, right? Augustine can say a thing that he's working out about what he believes about predestination and these kind of ideas that Calvin can cling on to and say, you know, everyone else was wrong. They didn't get it right. Augustine got it right on this kind of thing, right? And Calvinists can then follow in that tradition.
And you know what? I should say this as well. Calvin, he is reacting and maybe overreacting in some areas, but he's also making sure that we don't follow this one line of patristic thought off of a cliff because Pelagius has just done that.
Right.
That you don't want to emphasize human free will and accountability for action in such a way that it sounds like humans can save themselves. And so Augustine, I think, rightly is pushing back. So at times, I think he does push back too far. But it's you can have a much more nuanced kind of assessment. But there's a lot, you know, for instance, a Thomist, someone who's more in what's called the Benesian school in terms of looking at predestination, well within Catholic orthodoxy, can say, yeah, Augustine's actually onto something here that maybe others hadn't really noticed and appreciated. Not because he's like overruling and rejecting them, but that he's emphasizing a different aspect of this story that hadn't been getting as much play before and which needed to be focused on more to avoid the heresies of someone like Pelagius.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This makes total sense. Okay, I wonder in closing, Joe, if we can kind of sum this up in terms of, okay, so the Catholic encounters, you know, say an argument on YouTube or a Calvinist in person. I have wonderful Calvinist friends, and they're always the most passionate debaters, right? I don't know what it is about Calvinism, but you know, Calvinists know their theology, know why they believe it. I think pretty deeply, oftentimes, right? You can articulate that very.
I have a theory about that. Well. I don't know if it's here or there.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, in a nutshell, the Catholic response to that, like, what's at least one or two things that the Catholic can say or can understand to put that in perspective when they encounter that Calvinist on the street or on YouTube or wherever it might be?
Yeah, I think, okay, I'm going to throw out a few things. One, there's something intellectually satisfying about Calvinism. Like the different parts of Tulip hang together well. And I was talking with a guy who was a dispensationalist before and is now a Catholic. And he was pointing that this was also true of dispensationalism. And then I think he went to seminary or something and then discovered Calvinists and realized that the dispensationalists and the Calvinists, both of these elaborate theological systems that made internal sense if you accepted certain presuppositions, like, you know, total depravity in the case of Calvinism, rightly dividing the dispensations in the case of dispensationalism. And so it was very hard to critique from within, because it all made internal sense. But just seeing somebody else interpreting all the same data in a different constellation made this light bulb moment for him where he thought, well, how do I know this arrangement of the pieces is right and that one is wrong? Because, yeah, this one makes sense to me. That one makes sense to him. And I see why each of us are coming to the conclusions that we do. And so one of the first moves, I think, is just to acknowledge, like, yeah, I get why the system makes sense to you. You're not just like clinging to it because it's comforting. There's an intellectual integrity in saying, I'm going to follow this to its logical conclusion. Even if the logical conclusion seems like a bad picture of God, they're just committed enough to following the truth where it goes. And that's to be applauded. But second, you can then say, okay, well, if we need to figure out which of these systems is right, is it likely that the apostles taught this whole system of doctrine and nobody got it? Like nobody even got like the basic outline. Nobody's teaching anything like your closed puzzle. They're teaching a whole different puzzle. How likely is that? Because if you say they got one or two pieces wrong, fine. That makes sense. If you say they, you know, put together a bird and it was supposed to be a house, that doesn't seem like you can't just say, well, they're not infallible. They're not perfect. No, you're making a bigger claim than that. Like you're claiming they got the whole thing kind of wrong.
The birdhouse.
Yeah, nicely done. So that would be the second thing is just saying, like, when we talk about the need to go back to the early church fathers, it's not because we think they're inspired. It's because we think they get the basic picture right.
Yeah.
And if they don't get the basic picture right, we're all in trouble. I've said this part before, But like, why would we trust that they get Christology right or Trinitarian theology or the canon of scripture or any of the other issues? And then you're like, okay, well, look, it seems like they don't teach this. And then I think you can bring in the things people like Justin Martyr say, because I started to mention Justin Martyr earlier. He talks about several things. And again, he's responding to the Greek system where this was, they taught something sort of like Calvinism. And he says, unless the human race have the power of avoiding evil and choosing good by free choice, they are not accountable for their actions of whatever kind they be. Now, Justin says that. That's clearly what the early Christians say. Philip Schaff points out this is the standard view among the early Christians. He says the Greek, and particularly the Alexandrian fathers, in opposition to the dualism and fatalism of the Gnostic systems, which made evil a necessity of nature, laid great stress upon human freedom and upon the indispensable cooperation of this freedom with divine grace. And so he traces that as well as the Latin tradition, people like Tertullian, Cyprian, Hilary, and Ambrose, who emphasized free will and the sovereignty of God's grace, but without denying freedom and individual accountability. So they're focusing on different things because they're dealing with kind of different problems out there, just like Augustine was. But the two sides are saying the same thing. Like, yes, original sin is a thing. Yes, free will is a thing. And we have to work on how to make sense of those two things. But in this, one practical thing I sometimes do is I ask about the difference between rape and adultery from the level of sin. Because I've never met a Calvinist who thought being raped was a sin. And why not? Well, because the person who's raped has not willed this, has not chosen this. There's no free will. And so even if the action looks the same externally, the fact that in one case a person freely chose it and in another case it was forced upon them means that one person is morally culpable and the other person isn't. That is a basic moral intuition that no amount of Calvinism can really eradicate. And then you say, okay, so it seems like you know that what Justin is saying is true, that without free will, human behavior, we couldn't speak of good and evil. Like a hurricane isn't evil. It's just unfortunate. An animal isn't evil. It's just following its instincts. And so to speak of a good or an evil person presupposes and requires free will. And then the very last point, the other place you can go is Adam and Eve, because one of the failures in the Calvinist system. So remember, TULIP is really based on total depravity, but depravity is a result of the fall in this understanding. And so then you say, how does predestination work with Adam and Eve? And Calvinists don't agree with each other. There's what's called infralapsarian and supralapsarian Calvinists. Some who believe Adam and Eve were predestined to sin. Well, that doesn't make sense if you say this is all a result of the fall, because then he's chosen the fall. But if you say they freely chose sin, well, now you've got a free will problem. And so that, it, I mean, go that way at your own risk if you want to get into those deeper waters. But that would be kind of the basic outline of the things I would want to talk about with a Calvinist.
That sounds like a pretty fun dinner party, Joe.
I find Calvinists, like you already mentioned this, Calvinists more than basically any other group of Protestants are totally willing to go there and talk theology.
Yeah, yeah. And
I mean, because it's a very intellectual system.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not very rich emotionally, but it's very rich intellectually.
They're all dead inside, but know their stuff.
Really. I don't mean that. In terms of left brain, right brain people, yeah. I think you've got a hugely disproportionate number of left-brained Calvinists, whereas you can find softer-hearted, maybe evangelicals. But you're not going to, I'm imagining in the example you gave of the guy who came in as a Calvinist into your young adult group.
Yeah.
He's probably a smart guy. An intellectual, someone who read. So I have a real respect for the intellectual tradition. I think it's something that's easy to not take seriously enough as Catholics.
He was dead inside though, Joe, too. So that's the stereotype. Just know he was a great guy. He's a great guy. Joe, this has been a pleasure. A really fascinating, fun, deep topic that I'd love, and lots of listeners have requested we chat about this, so I'm glad I got you, Joe. Great guest. I think this was a wonderful tour of Calvinism. Very fun.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously much bigger than I can do it justice for. So if you're a Calvinist who said, like, why didn't you cover A through Z, or that was not very thorough, I probably agree with you. I'm just trying to give a kind of a basic primer of Tulip Double Predestination.
Thanks. And it's my fault. Things that we missed, I'm sorry, guys.
Sure, I'll accept that.
Yeah, don't blame Joe.
Well, it's Keith's fault, right? Everything to him.
Yeah. I'll take the credit for that.
He's very cordial.
Yeah, well, thanks. Joe, I'll put links to your fantastic books in the show notes, links to your podcast and stuff. Anywhere else you want to point people towards, or things you want to give them a heads up, things in the pipeline for you? What do you want to say?
Nothing too exciting. I mean, like you say, I'm doing a lot right now. I'm building up the podcast and trying to get more people to check it out, Shameless Potpourri. So I've got a book that I'm in the very, very early stages on, but too early to even announce what it's on.
Well, excited to find out when it comes out, Joe. I'm sure it's great. Like I say, your books are non-existent in my house because I lend them out. They're too good to hold on to. So I'm stealing money from you. Not at all.
That's the opposite of what I said.
That's wonderful. I don't know. We'll see. Joe, thanks for the work you do for the church. I want to say God bless you and your family and that work. And thanks for being here with us again today. Always a pleasure to have you, Joe.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a real joy to be here.
Thank you. Well, thank you, friends, for listening to another episode of the Cordial Catholic Podcast with Joe Heschmeyer, a fantastic guest, a good friend, a great guy, awesome apologist. I love his perspective on things. If you haven't checked out his podcast and YouTube channel, Shameless Potpourri, those links are in the show notes. Fantastic channel. It's growing leaps and bounds, and I am so pleased to see that happening because Joe's a great guy with awesome stuff to say. Check that out, Shameless Potpourri on YouTube or any podcatching app that you use. Let us know what you think of the show. CordialCatholic@gmail.com is our email address. TheCordialCatholic.com is our website. And we're on Instagram, on TikTok, on Twitter at Cordial Catholic, and on Facebook at The Cordial Catholic. Our YouTube channel is youtube.com/TheCordialCatholic to watch what you are hearing. And hey, if you can, our channel is growing, not by leaps and bounds, but by trickles and drabs, drips and drabs, I guess you'd say. So if you can help to grow that channel, that helps the algorithm to push our videos out to more and more people. YouTube is a really strange and fascinating place. There's lots of awesome place for debate and discussion and dialogue. It's rich theological ground. So if you head over there and subscribe to our channel, that'll help it to grow, and the algorithm will share the videos with more and more people. So head over there, youtube.com/TheCordialCatholic. And thanks, guys. Hey, listen, I'm praying for you. Please pray for me, too. Each and every week, know that I'm doing that for you. Thanks for listening, guys. Talk to you again next week. Take care, and God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcafe. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.